Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another Friday Ask Me Anything. I'm going to be doing things a little bit differently today because I've invited my friend, the Palestinian peace broker, Aziz Abu Sara, on to join me. Welcome to Wild once again, as it is. It's so wonderful to see your face, especially in the current predicament.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for having me. And it's always good to see your face as well.
I've asked you to join me to answer a question which has come up a number of times over the last couple of weeks and months as the crisis in the Middle East goes from, well, horrific to horrendously horrific. And the question is, what's the best thing we can do to be helping the peacemakers? I think there's a lot of people online, a lot of people in the Substack community, in my broader community, who are wanting to make sure they're doing the right thing. They're aware that there's a lot of noise going on, in particular on social media. I refer to it as almost causing a second conflict. There's the conflict, that's happening on the ground in the Middle East, and then there's the rest of us bickering backwards and forwards on the right way, the right level of noise, activism, silence, or otherwise, and a lot of taking sides. You're either with us or against us, all of that kind of thing. So I wanted to speak to you to get your take on what is most helpful right now, because you've gone backwards and forwards between the West. You've been in Australia shortly after October 7, so I think it was in November, which was all very, very raw and so on. You've been in the US, you've been in Europe at various conferences, peace conferences, and you've also been back in Israel and Palestine. And just as a bit of background for everybody, Aziz grew up in East Jerusalem, had an older brother who was killed by the Israeli military. He's a National Geographic explorer and TED fellow. He's one of the most influential, I guess, peace collaborators in the world. You've done negotiations in all different conflict zones, 60, I think, in total, including Syria and Afghanistan. Let me see, I'll just read the rest of your bio here. A TED fellow, founded and led countless global conflict resolution organizations, including Bereaved Families Forum and the Center for World Religions, Diplomacy and Conflict Resolution at George Mason University. I'll put a link to your bio because there's a link to your book and also the other sort of stuff that you do, which I'm sure is a little on hold at the moment. But as is, we chatted the other day, and I think this is a good starting point for a bit of a conversation that will lead to answering the question that everybody's been asking, what can we do to help the peacemakers? But you gave me a little bit of a feel for what is actually happening in the various peace movements around the world. And you said to me that there ain't a lot of peacemaking going on. Really, the focus is on a ceasefire and just stopping the carnage, the famine and everything else. But you also touched on the fact that there's some division, a lot of division happening in the peace community. So a lot of that hard work that had been done for decades is unraveling as well as everything else. Can you explain what you sort of said to me there? Give a bit of a picture of things.
Yeah, and I think a lot of us in the peace community afraid to face this reality, afraid to be honest and be transparent because it's something we haven't experienced before. We have not been in a situation where you see your partners in some cases have gone completely the other side, where in some organizations I know it's been hard to get the members to even meet, to even talk to each other, because there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of judgment, where people don't know where to start. I'll give you a couple of small examples. For Israelis, I've heard right after October 7th, where many of them felt that the Palestinian peace activists weren't quick in condemning what Hamas did. And some of them, I know I got some texts from Israeli activists saying, okay, we've seen you speak. Where are the others? Where are other partners who should have been as outspoken and been on the media and been sending us messages and checking on us? And so that caused a lot of hurt. And a couple of weeks later, the table turned completely as things started unraveling and the bombing of Gaza started. Palestinians started asking the same question, where are our Israeli partners? It got a little bit more complicated as many of our Israeli partners might have gone to serve in the Israeli army to be in Gaza.
Yeah.
And so that caused a lot of Palestinians to start asking, wait a second, what does that mean for our movement? Can you go and be a soldier in Gaza and then come back and we meet together and act like nothing has happened, that everything is good, we are best buddies, we're working for peace together? But in my mind, I'm thinking, what did you really do in Gaza? What happened there? And these are real issues that we've not really dealt with before that is happening now. Even what does it mean to be, I think it's causing us to ask the question, what does it mean to be a peace activist? You could be for war now and still be a peace activist somehow. You can be watching everything going on and be a peace activist. And I think that's absurd. If you're speaking for ceasefire, some people think you're not a good peace activist. So these kind of elements we have not seen before. And I would argue the peace movement is living into a crisis that we have never experienced before. On one hand, we've lost many, many members. And if anybody says that doesn't happen, is in denial. We did gain some new members as well, but we've lost so much. We are in a situation that's just quite scary.
Wow. So it's really mirroring what's happening in the rest of the world, in the States, in the UK, in Australia, where, you know, I mean, whole communities are dividing, you know, into sort of sides in this. And, you know, a lot of us had placed so much faith in these peace movements that were happening in the Middle East. You know, as you know, I was there at the end of 2022 and I saw these organizations. I was blown away by how these, particularly young people, were able to reach across and let go of education, misinformation, even personal experiences. In the cases of the, you know, the bereaved family groups and the combatants for peace, you know, these were people who had spent a decade in jail for throwing rocks, who were able to now go and work alongside, you know, the people who jailed them. What has seen it disintegrates around this? Because the conflict, there has been conflict there for decades. What really turned? I know there's the scale, but do you think that there's anything else going on that's actually made it impassable?
So let me start by saying, I think there are still some people who are doing incredible work and still able to do it. I think you mentioned two groups that are that I'm very involved with and has been dealing really well with what's going on and trying to get people and having conversations. Combatants, I think within 3-4 days of October 7th, we were doing events online for our members and for the public, having 1,000 people sometimes join us. So there were some of those. I think these couple of organizations are a bit different, although I wouldn't be surprised if some members, even in those organizations, would have felt, I don't want to be involved now. But those are a bit of a unique groups. I don't think it applies for everybody. But why in this time this is happening? I think in some ways the peace movement has gotten too comfortable and too weak already before October 7th. Our reach has become very diminished. You know, again, we talked about combatants and bereaved families forum. Bereaved families forum used to go into schools. Last year, we couldn't go into Palestinian schools or into Israeli schools anymore. We were banned from attending or doing any dialogue meetings into schools. And so slowly we were diminished. Actually, more recently, European countries such as Switzerland decided to cut funding for pretty much every human rights-focused organization in Israel and Palestine. Everyone. 11 organizations that were funded by the Swiss on November 1st were completely cut out of funding. And that also sent a message. It sent a message that says, if you disagree, if your human rights report, if your peace activism is not what we want it to be, if you say anything we don't approve of, we're going to cut you out of funding. And that's the more progressive European countries. Imagine when you go to the ones who are more conservative. So if you're a peace activist, you are facing losing your funding if you say anything that's offensive to anybody. If you are a peace activist, you live in a reality where if you are within Israel right now, it's really hard to even get permits to go protest. As recently as last week, people who are trying to arrange a protest get denied. If you are in Palestine right now, going out to even to talk about peace, people are looking at you like crazy. 30,000 people have been killed, and you want to come and talk to me about coexistence, what you're talking about. And so you find yourself in a very hard, hard place. And on one hand, your own people will look at you and say, are you crazy? But also you look at who are my partners, and you don't find huge amounts of people. There are some, and there are some who are truly dedicated. But I think if we're honest, there's a huge rebuilding needed that we have to think, what do we do? Where we fail? Because we have definitely failed as a peace movement. And if we're not willing to accept that, we will never succeed. There are things we've done that don't work. There are whatever activism we did hasn't reached the right amount of people. So what do we do now is a very important question. And I'm not sure I know all the answers, but I think these are questions we have to start asking ourselves.
What are some of the answers that you're mulling around with? As you say, you don't know yet, and I suspect you probably need to speak with more of the people again, be able to reach across to people on the other side to talk this stuff with, and then they're not there at the moment, or they're preoccupied, or they're actually fighting in the army.
I am meeting this week with about 60 Israelis and Palestinian activists. And that's part of what we are doing for 3 days, is meeting and trying to figure out some answers to those questions. I think one very important aspect is rethinking how we define what we do. It's not dialogue. Dialogue alone does not make a change. Dialogue alone does not create a sustainable movement. NGO systems does not change as well the world. I think we got too comfortable in creating so many nonprofits. There are hundreds now of peace NGOs, and nonprofits become too inwardly focused rather than movement focused. And if we cannot get people out of how do I build my own little kingdom NGO and make sure all of us get the salaries we need, it's not going to really spread. Movements are different than nonprofits. So that's another thing we really have to start thinking. How do we work together rather than I build my own organization? And it's very hard because, you know, I talked about funding. Funding mechanism is all about you fighting everybody else to get the salaries for your own staff. So that's one element. Another aspect that we haven't really tackled before is equality. In peace movement organizations, most of the money, most of the funding, most of the power is not equal. There are very few organizations that are equal. Combatants for Peace and Parent Circle are actually two that often try really, really hard to be. And they do embody that. But in most cases, the Israeli organization get the funding and the Palestinian peace activist is a subcontractor that works
with the Israeli. When I was there with you, I noticed that sort of it seemed to be that most of the organizations and the setups and the concepts were Israeli funded with Israeli people kind of at the top. And then there were Palestinians brought in to take part. Yeah. And I felt that.
And that's partially also comes from funding and international organizations, European, American, whatever it is, that don't trust the Palestinians and feel more comfortable with giving the money to the Israelis. However, it creates an infrastructure and imbalance of power. And you cannot have a true partnership when there isn't true equality between the two sides. So if I get my salary from you, Sarah, we not equal. Because you decide, if I say something off, you decide to throw me off that, you know, to fire me. So there are a few things that really needs to change within the movement. But probably the most important thing is we need to redefine our work as joint resistance, not joint dialogue. I think that is important. And it will be offensive to some people and some people will not like it. But dialogue alone, again, is not going to be enough. It's a joint resistance against pretty much every government, the Israeli government, the Palestinian government, and Hamas. I think all three are awful. There are different degrees of how awful each is, but all three are not helpful right now. I think it's joint resistance against any system of oppression, against killing of civilians, and we can't feel normal with so much violence happening around us. And I think in 2022, 2023, the level of violence has escalated significantly. And we got used to it. It became normal for us to wake up and hear two people get killed here, five people killed there. 22, 23 were the highest level of violence already in the last, I don't know how many years.
Yeah.
And we got so normalized with it. And that it's business as usual, kind of. And we can't accept that. We can't allow the dehumanization of people to exist. And that's, you ask what needs to happen now. I think first and foremost, we need to humanize the people who are there. The people in Gaza need to be humanized. So I try to share the stories of the people I know there because I want people to know these are human beings who have dreams, who have life. They weren't living in tunnels. The kids who are dying there are not nobody. Their lives do matter. And so I try to tell their stories. And honestly, in times when we don't have much we can do, telling stories is the most that we can do. And telling the stories of innocent people is extremely important. Not only those who are dead, those who are alive, and their stories before they died, not just their images as they are dead. I don't think that actually moves people as much.
I think it actually fires up anger as opposed to compassion, which is what's going to be required. I think we need both. We're going to have to get fired up in all kinds of directions. But I agree with you. I feel that it adds to the dehumanization when we see dead bodies. It's atrocious. And I think we need to be aware of the level of carnage that is happening. But I think eventually the more powerful messaging is to see Palestinians living out lives where I think a lot of Westerners are really kind of surprised by their ignorance around how they thought Palestinians lived. I think they're surprised by the level of sophistication, the level of education. I remember being there and hearing about the levels of education, especially amongst women in Palestine. These kinds of things, you start to get a real picture and there's a familiarity and a connection as opposed to these these people so far away? And I used air quotes just then for anyone who's listening and not watching the video version of all of this. You've touched on some stuff that I think many of the people who've asked this question, what can we do to help the peacemakers? You've touched on a few things. The idea of if you're going to share a social media post, show humanity, show people alive today and the stories of Palestinians as opposed to dead bodies. And I think you can also run the risk, can't you, of normalizing and numbing people to the death and the destruction and the famine and misery and despair if you have those images going through your feed over and over again. What else can people be doing? I think many of us feel that we need to be on social media because there's an awareness that legacy or mainstream media has a bias, and that has been shown. And I will put some links to the studies that show this quite convincingly, what's happening in the US in particular, but also in Australia. And I think there's a sense that there's a number of biases happening in different ways. And I think a lot of people are wanting to take to social media to correct that, to give voice in particular to the Palestinians. Is that a good approach? Because at the same time, social media dials up outrage. It rewards spats going backwards and forwards. It rewards taking a side as opposed to speaking out on an issue. And what it's doing is it's getting people to actually create enemies amongst themselves rather than uniting around what I think is the common enemy, and that is greed, you know, the geopolitical situation that exists between the US and Israel, et cetera, et cetera. We're forgetting that as we get trapped in the silos on social media. So can you give some, I guess, guidance for people around whether social media is helpful or a hindrance and how it should be used better to support the kind of work that you and these 60 people are going to be trying to do going forward, you know, off the back of this meeting that you're having?
So there are a few things that come to my mind. Let me try to organize them as much as possible. Back to the sharing and storytelling, there is a strong element of that, sharing the stories from people there, sharing a lot of what the locals, Israelis and Palestinian peace activists who are working together, who are, you know, not tokenized Palestinian activists, not people who are not really, you know, with underground doing stuff, share those people comments, their wisdom, what they're working on, because they're doing a lot of stuff. There are seminars, there are events, there are webinars all the time happening. And smaller group of people maybe are doing it, but it is happening. And I think sharing what these people are doing is extremely important because we need to empower those individuals. I don't care which organization they work for. We need to empower individuals. So I'm thinking of people like Elik El-Hanan, people like Ma'oz Inon, people like Hamza Awawde, people like Bassam Aramin, Suli El-Khatib.
And these for everyone listening, I'll get Aziz to share the handles or the links to these people so that everybody can follow them and work out for themselves whether the messaging is something they want to support.
I actually have a list on my website, not only peace activists, but some peace activists and some journalists that people ask me, who do I follow? Where do I get news? And I say, I don't read really newspapers almost at all because I have a hard time with what's, especially with Western media. So I follow people directly. I follow people who are in Gaza, I follow people who are in the West Bank, people in Israel, journalists I trust, many of whom I know, so it's a bit easier for me. And then I add to that list some peace activists, and it's like 20, 30 names that I put on Interact website, an organization that I work with.
I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And I imagine also, Aziz, a bit like me, I follow people and then I start to sort of see something where I think that doesn't align with where I think things should be heading and I unfollow them. It's a constantly curating that list, you know. I imagine you do the same. And at the moment, it's moving fast. It's moving fast, and some people are holding really well and being solid and compassionate and very much geared towards peace. And some people are losing it, you know, as this conflict deepens. But sorry, yeah. I interrupted. So yes, and follow people.
I look for people always, and the peace activism, who have for compassion for people, regardless whether they're Jewish or they're Palestinian, Muslim, Christian, that they don't care. People who are, as were horrified on October 7th, people who even spoke up against it, people who are worried for hostages, but also people who are looking at what's happening in Gaza and saying, this is absurd that we can live normal and talk about, well, the future will be better as we're watching and doing nothing about it. So I look for people who are not just going to say, you know, you mentioned don't take sides. I think that I worry with that sentence sometimes, because what does it mean to not take sides? And too often I feel it means let's not get involved. Let's do nothing.
Yes.
Let's just watch from far away. And I say, don't take sides, but take a stand. And the stand
we... That's a really good phrase. Take a stand, don't take sides. But I agree with you. Not taking a side can often mean that people do both sidism as well. That's a problem where you feel like, well, if I give some ground over here, I've got to do the same over here. No. It's about this and. So it's right. About holding multiplicities and complexities and not getting siloed and creating an enemy of the other. Because the enemy somewhat wonderfully for most of us is not other humans that we can point at. It's a system. It's a system, right. and it's so much larger than the individuals that we're raging at the moment. So again, I interrupted you, but I'm glad you made that point.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. I think if we take a stand, that means we have something we believe in. And look, I've been critical of the Palestinian government. I've been very critical before October 7th and after of Hamas, who I do not subscribe to their way of thinking ever. And I've been critical of the Israeli government, but I've worked in other conflicts around the world. And I think when people today feel, oh, if you criticize this or that, it makes you antagonistic to the people who live in that country. I find that to be absurd, because I'm extremely critical of the United States and I split my time between here and Jerusalem. I love this country, but I think its leadership is immoral to the point of not sure who to vote for in the next election. And I can't stand the Palestinian leadership. It doesn't make me in any way anti-Palestinian. I think me looking at the Palestinian leadership, and as recently as this week made public statements against the Palestinian leadership, it doesn't make you anti-Palestine if you're saying, well, Abbas needs to go and Hamas is terrible. I have no problem with that. And the same with Israel. I think speaking against systems, speaking against government, speaking against actions of armies or actions of militants, I'm totally fine with that. I have no problem whatsoever with people being outspoken about that, because what else can we do? If you don't hold those with power accountable, then we are joking. And that's the part that goes back, what does peace activism really mean? If I can't criticize those with power, then who? Then how do we work on peace? And I think that that's the element that often is missing. How can I go next year to Gaza and meet with the people there and tell them, I want you to work with me for peace. I want you to support me for peace. What am I going to be able to offer them? That's a question I ask myself. And the truth is, without strong presence and support from my Israeli partners, I can't. I literally can't. And I understand it's the same for them. Without me going to say, hey, we need to talk about peace with Israelis, without me showing up and speaking up, they can't. And yet, right now, it's so hard to be able to speak up. It's so hard to speak for even humanitarian reasons. I had this guy who put me on a list on social media as one of the peace activists. I didn't check his list, But then I saw some comments after. It's like, how could you call this guy a peace activist? Look at his criticism of Israel and support for Hamas, which I've never supported Hamas. But because I was saying we need ceasefire, because I was saying too many innocent people and one innocent person being killed is too many, are being killed. This is not a war that will bring peace. It'll bring more destruction. It'll bring more hatred. They thought, oh, then you can't be a peace activist. And I'm thinking, speaking truth is also peace activism. And you yes. will find Palestinians who will define themselves as peace activists who will not dare to say a word of criticism against Israel. And you will find some of them in Australia invited to speak at certain events. And that tokenism, to me, is absurd. It's finding the good Arab who will come and tell you, hey, we should all hug, and yes, and I will not say anything. No Palestinian will ever listen to me if that's what I'm going to do. I will never be accepted as a leader, but also I'll be lying to you if I'm not honest with you and telling you, here's what I think, here's what I feel. And so what we need is people to amplify these messages, again, of Israelis and of Palestinians who are coming together and who are working together. And there are many, many of those of us. Well, not too many right now, but there are enough of us on social media that you can amplify those messages. You can help humanize the people who live there. And you have to be honest and say reality right now is not good, and it's probably not going to be good in the short term. And we have to support these individuals to hopefully cause a change. I'm not optimistic in the short term. The only reason I do what I do is I feel obligated, not optimism. It is because what other choice do I have? But it's unfortunately not an optimistic time.
I feel much the same, and I feel that a lot of what we need to be doing is to actually almost gird our loins for worse and for more challenging times. This, I feel, is only the beginning, and so we need to actually get better at handling the complexities. And one of them is as you say, being anti the Israel government doesn't mean you're anti-Semitic. Being anti-Hamas does not mean you're in any way unsympathetic to what's going on with Palestinians. And I'm wondering, do you see a difference between, as I say, you've been in Australia, you've been in the US, you're observing what's happening in Western media and on the ground, and then you also know what's happening on the ground in the Middle East. Is there a difference, or is it pretty much the same? You've sort of spoken to what's happening in the peace movement. It seems to be, you know, mirroring what's happening for me here in Australia online and so on, where you can't say anything without about four different perspectives being thrown at you, as in you're this, you're saying too much, you're not saying enough, you're too this, you're too that. On the ground in Israel and Palestine right now, are people able to hold those thoughts better than we are? Or is it much the same, that everybody's siloing? Because I think my understanding is that Palestinian support for Hamas has gone up, just as Israeli support for the Netanyahu government has gone up, even though October 6, you know, prior to October 7, people, massive amounts of people were protesting the government.
I would say even worse. It's not for Netanyahu himself. He's not that popular yet in Israel, but Israeli support for the policies that are very right-wing when it comes vis-a-vis the Palestinians has gone significantly up. Not necessarily the Netanyahu, but like, you know, what do you want to do with Gaza kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's because they're pissed off that he didn't respond and wasn't prepared on October 7th. They think that was a failure.
Partially for it.
Yes, but in terms of IDF, the IDF's approach, and also the right wing's influence, which, you know, a lot of Israelis were against, you know, prior to October 7th, you're saying that there's actually now a swing towards that right
thinking. And there's more Palestinians who see there's no hope for a negotiated peace agreement. There is a similar between Israelis and Palestinians. I try not to think of how people are responding now, because I think in a time like this, most of us respond out of anger and not out of rationality. And I'm hoping later on we all can think, okay, we don't have really another alternative but to find a way to live together.
So we'll have to forgive each other for our extreme kind of reactions. And I think that's something to bear in mind, because a lot of people are getting very upset with what they're seeing online. They're seeing friends becoming very siloed and not capable of seeing that the enemy is the system. It's not the other, that we don't have to other. But we've got to forgive each other for that in the short term.
Mute some of your friends who have... Yes. Are doing so much.
I've
of
had
that.
To restrict and mute a fair bit. Doesn't mean you've got to block them, but you can mute and restrict them.
And partially it's to save a friendship for later. I've told a couple of my friends, look, right now it's just so hard for me to hear what you have to say. Not because I think everything they're saying is wrong. It's just I think they've gone so hardcore that there's no point of me going and arguing and debating. And I think arguing and debating never really changes people's minds. And they're like, no, let's get on the phone. Let's argue it. And I'm like, I don't want to fight with you. I know you hurt. I know you are. And when people hurt, they're not going to listen. And so I say, I want to be your friend, but this is not the time for us to argue it. Let's give it a few more months and then we might be able to talk. And they were not very happy about it. But there is big difference, I think, between Israel, Palestine, people there, and people in Australia. In Israel and Palestine, I would say a lot of people know directly somebody who might have been hurt. They have, they kind of live it a lot more. And
of course,
it's directly affecting you. In Australia, you're not directly impacted by it in the sense you're not living in Gaza, you're not living in the south of Israel, you're not living in the north of Israel. So you're not in the West Bank. So you are getting secondhand what's going on. And I think there's a lot of guilt that affects how people respond. So
that's a really good point. I think there's a lot of other stuff that's going on because, as you say, you know, there's a lot of other conflicts in the world that we could be getting worked up about in terms of people who've been displaced and have been massacred and are in famine. However, this particular conflict, and there are some people, of course, who are directly affected in that they may have a relative in Palestine, even Lebanon now, but also Israel, one of the hostages perhaps, et cetera, et cetera. So there's people who might have a bit of a link there. But I think the guilt piece, I think there's a lot of stuff going on for those of us who are watching predominantly on social media. I think there's a lot of mirror reflecting coming back at us where we're having to confront perhaps our own complacency that has existed prior to all of this, our lack of awareness of the Palestinian situation in particular, our inability to deal with the complexity of the world, and that maybe we've had our head in the sand. I think it has surfaced a whole range of stuff, and that's what I see might be playing out. Is that what you're referring to there, Aziz?
That's one of it. I think for each community, that guilt is different. For the Jewish community, it's a guilt of not being there and feeling like you got to support the people in Israel, and you not being there feels like you have to support them by being where you are, and there's a lot of Israeli government directed messaging that tells you this is what we expect from you. And the Palestinian
Is that being sent out to
absolutely.
People in the US?
I mean, one of the Israeli spokes people, he's been doing a tour on campuses and all over the US, and his message is your job here is to defend Israel.
I've heard that with journalists. The journalists have been invited to sort of meetings where they're getting briefed and so on. And, you know, I know this because journalists I know have refused to go, have said, no, I'm not going to be part of this. But yes.
Right. And the other side, you got the Muslim, the Arab communities who also feel guilt of being hopeless and helpless and feel they need to go out in the streets and they feel they have to share all the stuff on social media, and that guilt makes them very hard activists. So you get the hardcore pro-Israel kind of on one side, you have your hardcore pro-Palestine on the other side, that motivated out of guilt, and both will be going after you, the other Australians, I guess, or Americans, or wherever you're from, trying to convince you to be, you know, if you are Muslim, Arab, saying, hey, here's what's going on in Gaza. If you are, if the people coming from the pro-Israel, here's the stories of the hostages. And so everyone is fighting for your sympathy, your compassion, your support. You need to stand with kind of our people.
You're with us or you're against us.
Or you shouldn't take any stand whatsoever. You shouldn't have any opinion because you're a white woman living in Australia. And why should you talk about Israel and Palestine? The reality is you do because our countries, I can talk about the U.S., are very involved in that region. It's not like we have nothing to do with it. We are very involved diplomatically, we're very involved financially, we have a lot of connections, we have supported, the US gives a lot of billions of dollars worth of weapons, aid, so on. So to say we have nothing to do there is crazy. But also, the US has been, like in every other situation where the US is involved, Americans do speak and they do object and they do speak up, but it doesn't become such a crazy thing like it has now. So like when the US went and invaded Iraq, Americans did speak up about it and hundreds of thousands of people did protest against it. And it didn't mean you become traitor to the United States because of that. People had strong opinions about the U.S. involvement in Syria. Should they not? In Libya, should they should not? It's not like Americans, oh, they never cared and suddenly they do. And I think many did, and many did send tons of aid to people in Syria. Right now, 3 out of 4 of the hungriest people in the world are in Gaza. It's not like a minor humanitarian crisis. It's a huge humanitarian. 3 out of 4 in the whole world. That's... You know, I can understand people saying this is not a big issue if it wasn't. But in reality, numbers-wise, within 5 months, this became one of the worst, if not the worst place to live on Earth. There's no drinkable water. There's no food. Yes. I have friends there. I have families of my friends there who are literally starving. And none of us can do a thing. We can collect money and we don't know how to send it.
Let's go back to that because I'm aware of your time. I want to cover off maybe just a few of those practicalities, if there are any, because, you know, I'm really getting a sense that it is as impossible as we feel it is right now. And in some ways, perhaps the best advice is that we're just going to have to sit in this horrible complexity and lack of power and the powerlessness for quite some time, but which I feel anyone who's lived in the Middle East is at least they're used to that. You know, they're used to the impossibility of it all. We are getting insight into that and it's crazy making, right? You know, anyone who's been to the Middle East, into Israel, into Palestine, it is crazy making. You cannot fathom, you know, we're a culture that wants to fix things, find a solution, a black and white, you know, answer. And it just doesn't exist in this part of the world and in this kind of conflict. But in terms of tangibilities, Siobhan, who's a wonderfully regular commenter on my Substack, she's asked if I can ask you, things like boycotts, things like protests, petitions, sending money, that kind of thing, are any of those helpful? Are any of them absolutely not helpful? In the past, I know you've said boycotts are not helpful, but do you feel that things are different now? And are there any strategies that maybe we haven't thought of that we can help out with?
I've never been a fan of boycotts, mainly because my study of boycotts hasn't shown it to be the most effective way. In the same time, it's funny because I apply, if I think something is unethical, I don't buy it. So it's hard for me to tell people don't boycott. I just know politically it has rarely worked. I've seen it in the US with Chick-fil-A from the LGBTQ community, and Chick-fil-A that year made more money than the year before because it actually pushed everybody on the other side to go and buy from Chick-fil-A. So I've seen it not work as well. I saw Caterpillar, which was boycotted by Palestinian groups, that it didn't even do a dent with that company.
It can swing the other way.
Right. And again, at the same time, I wouldn't tell people don't to use boycott because it is people's right to do so. I just don't know if it's the most effective. Sending money, yeah, it depends though who and where you send it. Right now, I would do mostly helping people directly if you can, and I'm happy to put a few.
That'd be great.
A few fundraisers. We've been collecting money that goes 100% to people, with no overhead from us. But like the people who escaped Gaza who managed to get out, they got nothing. So we can't get money into Gaza, but you still got thousands of people who left. And people who left had to pay thousands and actually tens of thousands of dollars to get out. They sold everything they owned in Gaza and they've literally went into debt. Their families, if they had family abroad, mortgaged their homes sometimes to be able to spend. It cost up to $10,000 to just get you out. And it's per person. So
I have a link to somebody who is working and getting Palestinians out and into Australia, and they're living at his home. And these people are qualified people who are now going to be looking for work. And I think there's going to be sort of networks that are set up in that way.
Or help them. Like I know a family of somebody, a friend who's got his wife and two kids just recently. He now has to rent them an apartment in Cairo. He's in the U.S. finishing his master's degree on a scholarship, but he has to rent a place for his family in Cairo for the next year. He has to give them food and, you know, put the kids in schools, all of that. And that's thousands of dollars. So that's, I would focus on those. I would say also not only Gaza, please don't forget also the West Bank. In the first few weeks after October 7th, 11 villages were ethnically cleansed. By settlers. And we ended up...
While we were looking the other way.
Right. And nobody paid attention. And so we with a few... This is where I think co-resistance worked. We with organizations like Rabbis for Human Rights started working together on collecting money and taking food and water. And the reason I needed a Jewish organization is because me as a Palestinian couldn't get to those villages. But they could. And so we played around the loopholes of the system to get food, medical aid, water to these villages. So there are places like this that are very important. Don't think there's only need in Gaza. Unfortunately, the need is both in Gaza and in the West Bank. So that's also important in the aid aspect. You mentioned protests. I think protests are important. It is important we also careful about what messaging we are sending. I've been to some protests where protests are so big, usually where you have different messages in different parts of protests. I try to stick to where I feel the messages align to what I believe. And I think protests do show an important element of what we want from our politicians. So I personally have no issue. We protested I think you might have even seen the protests in Israel when you came in Tel Aviv.
Yes.
So there were protests there, and I thought it was important to go to that. Protested against the Palestinian Authority before. I don't see why not to protest, to push our governments to want ceasefire. I think that's fine.
Can I ask one? This might be a little bit controversial, but given that there's a US election coming up and the US is probably the biggest player in all of this from whatever angle you want to look at it, is there a role to be played in speaking to our American friends and perhaps even to our Jewish American friends about what's going to play out in the election at the end of this year? Do you think that that's a good use of energy, or is it just too fraught?
No, I think it is a good use of energy, because the U.S. next elections has changed the map of how the next election is going to work, has completely changed because of what's going on in Gaza. And people might like it, hate it. This is a reality. And I've heard some denialism of like, no, Biden numbers have gone down significantly, but had nothing to do with it, even though it happened right after October 7th.
I think there's consensus now that it's got a lot to do with Israel. And so if the Democrats can change their tact and differentiate themselves from Trump in that way, you know, it'd be a huge relief.
Not necessarily even just because of the policies. It's the language. Like, when Biden is asked about Palestinians who've been killed, his first response is, let me tell you about the hostages. Now, there's a space to talk about the hostages. It's important to talk about the hostages. But if the first thing that comes to your mind when somebody mentions Palestinians who are killed is the hostages, you are really tone deaf. You really don't understand the pain the Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, younger people in the United States are feeling. He's lost many people from the African-American communities. And it's just the messaging has been so off the book, so crazy. Lack of empathy is just unbelievable. Like, when you talk about Palestinians, they're not the humans, literally, with this administration.
Kamala Harris has come out just the last couple of days, and her language seems to have shifted quite dramatically. So I feel...
To be fair, her language was always a little better than Biden, but I don't think Kamala Harris...
The fact that she's actually out in public talking all of this...
I don't think that will make a difference.
No,
I think unless Biden himself... And look, this is an open secret, but it's known now that the policy regarding Israel and Palestine is only decided by a handful of people in the White House, not in State Department, not even in the Ministry of Defense, not in the Pentagon. It's only Biden and literally a handful of people around him who are making these policies. He's very strongly involved in this. He has very strong opinions on Israel, and it has been really shocking how little empathy he has. Even on the issue of humanitarian aid, there were many stories about how people in the White House has been pushing him to say, we need to get more aid in, and how he just didn't really
care. I was wondering about whether that was political opportunism.
The response we often get to that, and I think this is important, oh, but Trump will be worse. And this is the dumbest thing, honestly, you can tell an Arab or a Palestinian or a Muslim in America. You telling us, 30,000 people have been killed and the US government is hardcore supportive of that, but Trump might be worse. Like, worse than what? Because we've had Trump before. He banned Muslims from coming to America. Okay, that's not worse than killing people. He actually was less into getting into wars, not in Syria and Libya and all these places. And I can't stand Trump, and I don't want him to win the next elections. But this language of, well, whatever Biden does, you still need to support him.
What should Americans do, and what should we do in terms of trying to, I don't know.
I think what Michigan did was brilliant, is they didn't vote against him. This is the primaries. You have to show him how unhappy people who would vote for him are. The uncommitted vote was brilliant, brilliant political pressure. It doesn't risk anything because he's going to win the primaries. But it shows him what he could risk in the general elections. And maybe it will get him and his advisors, those handful of people, to realize this is really stupid policies. If it's repeated in other primaries, just like happened in Michigan, I think that would make a difference. I don't know if it will happen or not, but I hope it does. 100,000 people, significant number, went out in Michigan to vote uncommitted. It was 10 times more than even the organizers expected.
That's interesting. Okay, so you've given us a lot to work with here, and also I think a lot to think about and reflect on and deal with, and that is this idea that there is not an easy answer. If anybody thought that I was going to get a nice checklist of solutions from you, as is, they'll be disappointed. That said, I guess the final question I want to ask you is, how are you coping with all of this? I mean, it affects you personally in terms of having friends and family there. No doubt you've lost friends and family from both sides in this. And I'm wondering, And of course, your work, your whole life's mission is affected because it's in peril. And as you say, you're not optimistic, but you feel, what was your word? You feel obligated?
Obligated.
Mm. How are you coping with this, I don't know, philosophically, spiritually, psychologically? What are you doing to frame it so that you can get up each day and keep doing what you feel obligated to do?
I think I'm very, well, one, the fear for your family, for your friends, for the people you know is very paralyzing. And the first few weeks, it was the worst. And unfortunately, in some ways, we learn to live with these awful things that's going on, and it's horrible to even think about it. I try so hard not to normalize it, not to feel it's normal, that it's, I don't need to check the news today. It's a privilege that I can wake up and not check the news. But like you said, my family is there, so I have to check on them every day, make sure they are right, make sure they are safe. So that's one element that's hard. I try to work a lot. The more I work, the less time I have to dwell on awful things and think about them. But I'm also fortunate in some ways that I do have incredible partners, both Israelis and Palestinians that I work with. And partners, I can tell them truly what I think, and I can fight with them sometimes and argue and debate, not in the sense who's right and who's wrong, but really share my frustration, share my anger, and that they wouldn't judge me on that one moment. And likewise, they can do the same. A few days after October 7th, one of my really good friends, an Israeli who lives in Germany, called me, and I answered, was FaceTime, and I said, hey, how are you? How are you feeling? I hope your family's okay. And he said, yeah, my family's okay, but I called you because I need to yell, I need to cry with somebody. And he literally just broke down, started crying. And so for the next whatever time, we just both cried together and said a lot of awful things I can't even repeat here, but it was okay. And you need those people in your lives. And I'm very fortunate to have those people. I don't think everyone does, unfortunately. But having Israeli, especially friends who I can feel that comfortable with, has been very helpful for healing, that I'm not alone and I don't know who to talk to.
Yeah. Sorry, I've got a bit teary there because I've had to do similar stuff. I've had to hold a very calm, measured public persona. And the other night I just raged with two friends, and I raged at them and begged them for forgiveness sort of every 5 minutes. And they said, nah, just keep doing it, keep doing it. And I'm very grateful to have been able to do that. I think it's important, to do that, but to maybe do it with people who you can trust and where your rage won't then be algorithmically blown out of proportion and used to make money for Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg. Aziz, thank you so much for this conversation. I've learned more than I expected to learn. I'm sure a lot of people will. This will actually appear as a video on my Substack page, and subscribers can watch it as a video. They get to see your beautiful face and man bun. I'm wondering, and also they can join the conversation. They can see the links. So I'll have all the links to various newspaper articles and issues that we've touched on, but also the links to various organizations and people that you can follow. And you can join a conversation where we have very mature, grounded discussions about these complex issues with each other. And Aziz, if you have time, I'd invite you to join that conversation. I'll send you the link when it's up, and I'm sure people would love to share their thoughts with you and their gratitude for this conversation.
Absolutely.
So everyone's invited to join the conversation, a nice conversation where we will put in practice a lot of the stuff that you've talked about with us here in terms of how to manage all of this and do it better. We need to be actually modeling what we're going to require going forward, and we can do that now. That's our choice. Thank you so much for your existence on this planet, Aziz. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you. Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.